Now that I thought about it, just how did Marco know what I was doing and thinking while I was in the bar? He wasn't there to witness it. I knew from experience that Paul withheld things from me when it was in my interests or when he had other reasons to do so. However, while not deceptive, he definitely can be evasive and circuitous when he has a mind to be. You once told me that I am not a mind reader and that I never will be, I said. Yes, that's right. That was in the context of a discussion on telepathy. I concluded then that telepaths are not mind readers. A fairly reasonable if not totally infallible conclusion, I would say. If Marco wasn't in the bar and if I wasn't transmitting thought messages to him, how was it that he was able to warn me to stop and get out of that mess? After all, he's not a mind reader, is he? Paul smiled. That finally occurred to you, did it? I wondered if you would ever figure it out. But you apparently have, and I must say that I'm impressed. I commend you, he said. You disappeared right before I got the message at the bar. Could that be related in any way? It could, and it was, according to Paul. He had wanted to teach me a lesson while at the same time extricating me from a situation that had the potential to alter the rest of my life in a way that I could not find advantageous. In fact, it was more than just potential, Paul said. I had been on a slippery slope to tribulation and had avoided that destination at the last moment. He felt it crucial to intervene. He declined to discuss it in any detail except to admit that while I was so preoccupied with the seductive woman, he had contacted someone, an entity he called it, who had contacted someone, another entity, who contacted Marco, who transmitted the message to me without fully knowing the situation. Apparently, a lot of trust was involved. In short, the episode had been orchestrated by Paul to shock me out of whatever spell I was under. I suppose he had a good reason to reach out to the intermediaries rather than sending the message himself. It never occurred to me to ask him the point, but I suppose the fact that I was essentially ignoring him at that time could have had something to do with it. I spent a good portion of October bearing down seriously on trying to develop any paranormal skills I might have. I made regular progress in small steps. There were no big breakthroughs. In the beginning, the messages I received I concentrated exclusively on Marco were more like hunches, intuition. By the end of the month, I was receiving fairly well-formed ideas, although they were not structured as language. That is, they didn't come in the shape of silent words inside my head. They were more abstract, more cryptic thoughts without form. Though it seemed to be going slowly, even so I was able to receive enough information to confirm that Marco indeed had begun to receive my projections to him. By the end of November, every once in a while a thought would take the form of one or two sentences of silent words in my head. As 2002 came to a close, I had become fairly proficient, I thought, in reaching Marco. January brought no improvement over the level of achievement I had attained by the end of December, even though I was working harder than ever. I thought that perhaps I had gotten into the rut by restricting myself to practicing with Marco exclusively. It was time to branch out, to try to reach other telepaths. Except for one minor incident I don't know if it can be called a breakthrough. About the middle of January, 2003, there has been no further improvement. Contact with someone other than Marco came about after I had mentioned to Paul I met with him twice during that month that I seemed to have hit a plateau that I couldn't rise above. He suggested tactfully that perhaps I was not applying myself as diligently as I could, that perhaps I was unwilling to make the extraordinary sacrifice that normally is required when someone is determined to break away from the pack. He encouraged me to continue practicing. It can't hurt, he said, and you may discover some improvement along the way. I was irritated by the lack of progress because I sincerely believed that I was applying myself to my full potential. But I had to give his suggestions serious consideration because in any disagreement between us the odds were that he was right and I was wrong. So I stuck with it. At the same time, I sought his advice and counsel on how I might go about trying to reach someone other than Marco. He merely repeated the general rules, which I was already familiar with, about how to relax to help prepare the mind, to open oneself up, and a few other platitudes. In other words, His best advice didn't give me any new insights and didn't help me much as far as I could tell. I tried a number of experiments, including trying to repeat the incident at the mall involving the young Asian woman, though I still wasn't convinced that that was anything but one big coincidence. Nevertheless, as Paul said, I had nothing to lose, so I sat myself down in the same food court. I tried to replicate the previous conditions as much as was possible, sitting at a table with a diet cola. The soda was merely incidental. I'm sure the formula is a closely guarded company secret, but I doubt that it imparts psychic powers to the consumer. I also had my nose poked into a book. I had no idea what percentage of the population would be considered accomplished telepaths. Those who have developed their latent abilities, are aware of it, and actively engage in telepathic communication. That is, was it closer to 1 in 100 than 1 in 1,000,000? Would I be able to randomly contact one if that person was in the mall at the time? Also, how far away would be too far for me to establish contact, down the street or halfway round the world? This was all new territory to me, and it was patently obvious that there was so much that I didn't know. I made a mental note to try to sit down and have a long talk with someone who could educate me on these matters. I sat quietly with my eyes closed and let myself relax. When I thought I was in the right frame of mind, I listened for any random thoughts that might be floating around. After about 10 minutes, and not getting any indication, I tried randomly transmitting, projecting thoughts to any other telepath who might be able to pick up my signal. After another 10 minutes, I switched again to receiver mode, then back again. I did this alternately about every 10 minutes. About an hour into the experiment, just when I was ready to call it quits and head for home, I thought I detected something. It might have been just a random thought that I mistook for something else. But, no, it started getting stronger. It was definitely a communication. I became quite energized and had to force myself to remain sitting quietly so as not to draw any untoward attention. This was nothing short of amazing. It was a woman, definitely. I don't know how, but I could sense it. She was saying hello. She had received my random transmission. Any moment I half expected to hear "breaker, breaker." But I wasn't hearing words. These were random, unarticulated thoughts. They grew stronger by the moment. I was having a physical reaction to the excitement, similar to the intensity of feelings I had experienced in the bar with Sheila, but without the terror. In fact, there was something approaching bliss, and my heart thumped and my breath grew short. I warned myself to be careful not to hyperventilate. Yes, I was definitely receiving. Now there was no doubt whatsoever. A few words began breaking away from the jumble of thoughts and distinguished themselves as soundless speech in my mind. She was telling me that she had received my thought projections with great clarity. I didn't know if that was because of my ability to transmit, her talent to receive, or a combination of the two. But she congratulated me on my aptitude, which meant that I had succeeded in sending a strong signal. I could barely contain myself. I looked around the half-full food court to see if there was any obvious indication of who the sender might be. No one stood out. If my signal was as strong as she indicated, then it was possible that we could have a dialogue, although there was still an imprecise element to the communication I was receiving. I had to do a lot of interpreting because it was a mixture of unheard thoughts and unspoken words. Soon they began to coalesce into simple phrases and incomplete sentences. But I could make sense of it, that was the important thing. Who was she? Friend. Was she in a food court? Number. Was she in the building? Number. How old is she? Young adult. Was she single, married, widowed, divorced, engaged? Single. What did she look like? Average. I had to meet her. I didn't care if she was 90 years old and as ugly as a warthog, she was fascinating. This whole affair was remarkable. Can we meet? Sorry. Was that a denial? Maybe she was sorry about something else. I wasn't sure what the word meant in this context. I must meet you. Can't do. Where do you live? Far. I don't mind. I'll travel. Too far? No, it's not. I'll fly if it's too far to drive. I waited. No response. 30 anxious seconds passed. "What's your name?" I implored. No response. I started to panic. I tried to force myself to concentrate, but all that did was cause me to become more anxious, which in turn interfered with my concentration. I was losing her, could feel her slipping away. And then she was gone. The link was broken. I sat for 45 minutes trying to remain calm in an attempt to re-establish contact. It was hopeless, of course, because my attempt to achieve a placid state was in fact, paradoxically, an act of desperation. Despite numerous attempts to renew the connection, to this day I have not heard from her again. She remains an enigma who entered my life for a few brief, mesmerizing moments, a mystery woman who has attained a leading role during periods when I indulge in fantasies and daydreams. That also was the end of my progress as of this writing. The plateau I had reached was finite, it seemed. I could go no further, and so I have resigned myself to the possibility that I will never become a full-fledged telepath. Even my contact with Marco has become sporadic and has stabilized at what I consider an elementary level. However, using the general population as a standard, I have to admit that I have achieved something priceless, even if it is crude compared to the skills of accomplished telepaths. I consider myself extremely fortunate to have had the opportunity to communicate with the mystery woman, however briefly, and that I am still able to communicate with Marco at times. Of course, I will keep trying to improve my skills. I suspect that the important work that lies ahead for me, as described by Paul, may require me to become even more skillful in this arena, and so I continue to hang on to a sliver of hope that someday new heights will beckon me to resume my climb. If that happens, I will meet the challenge enthusiastically, happy to abandon the plateau on which I am currently stuck. Observation by Paul: a fool seeks vengeance. The wise man seeks justice. Lonesome journey. Everybody eventually will fall into two major demographics: the mourners and the mourned. Those who survive into old age do so at the cost of seeing most of their friends, relatives, and acquaintances die off. Those who are spared the grief of witnessing those deaths do so at the cost of being the ones lowered into the ground as those who survive them shed the tears of sorrow. I have reached a point in my life where more friends, relatives, and AC acquaintances are dead than alive. In October of 2002, one of the last of my closest friends died shortly after turning 67. He was a retired Los Angeles Times reporter and the man who, as managing editor of a community newspaper, had hired me as a cub reporter in 1963. In recent years, he and I had two or three phone visits a week, each lasting about an average of an hour. Even though he was nearly a year younger than I, he was a wise man from whom I learned much over the years. I looked upon him as my mentor when we first met, and that relationship developed into a friendship that lasted nearly 40 years. The last lesson I ever learned from him was priceless. He taught me how to die. When he broke the news to me on the telephone less than 2 months earlier that he had just received a diagnosis of a terminal illness, I reacted as one would expect with shock, sadness, and despair. Yet he was the one who offered the consoling words to comfort me rather than the other way around. He talked about his philosophy of life, which in essence was complete acceptance of the reality of the fact that one is born, lives, and dies. He was totally prepared for that final phase of his life. My friend accepted his fate with equanimity. As far as I know, he did not go through the four phases that terminal patients typically experience upon hearing the bad news. He did not go into denial, he was not overcome with fear, and he did not go through a period of ragging anger. He went directly to acceptance and peace of mind. I marveled at his strength that allowed him to face death with such serenity and composure. I have seen people of faith, who professed to believe in God, an afterlife, and heaven, face the same news hysterically, grasping in terror at any straw, even allowing themselves to be manipulated and exploited by quacks and charlatans in a desperate attempt to forestall the inevitable. And yet my friend faced the same inescapable fate without benefit of such faith to sustain him, provide him comfort, and assure him that he wasn't a road to salvation in which he would be granted everlasting life. He was an atheist, and atheists face the great unknown alone. My wife and I went to visit him once after the diagnosis, and he talked about how his impending death had enriched his remaining days, had given him new insights on a host of matters, and had even strengthened his marriage. I admired him for his courage and was deeply moved by the aplomb and sense of peace he displayed. I made a date to visit him again a few days later on a Sunday morning. But he slipped silently away on the eve of my planned visit as he reposed on the couch, surrounded by his family, watching the World Series on television, if I recall correctly. There was a time when I didn't know any people who had died, I told Paul shortly after the memorial service. Those were such innocent days. Now, it seems that most of the people I have been close to during my lifetime are dead. It's the price one pays for longevity, Paul replied. The price becomes steeper the older one gets. I nodded in understanding. The mourning period passed, as such things inevitably do, and I got back into the routine of my life. I traveled to Minneapolis in November to speak at an annual New Age event known as the Edge Life Expo. Paul was my only traveling companion, and we spent a lot of time over that weekend together. I flew into the city on a Saturday, spoke on Sunday, and returned home Monday. I was relaxing on the bed of my hotel room Sunday evening, watching nothing in particular on the TV, when I began to wonder just how much influence any guardian angel has upon the day-to-day life of the one whom it looks after. Paul was sitting on the edge of the bed, but there was no telltale depression on the mattress to indicate any weight upon it. We had been informally chewing the fat on subjects ranging from life, death, destiny, world conflict, terrorism, health concerns, and any of a dozen other topics. Something during that discussion probably triggered a train of thought about angelic influence on everyday life, but I can't pin it down to anything specific. I put the question to Paul. Well, it can't be quantified, he replied. It varies from one individual to another. There's no set ratio or formula. Okay, then how about my case specifically, I said. I repeat, it can't be quantified. I will say, however, that you have been a handful relatively speaking. Most protectors are not kept hopping the way you have kept me jumping from one crisis to another throughout your life, he said. He was grinning slightly, but I think he may have been only half joking. Because every day is different, he told me, the amount of time spent interceding in my affairs for my own good had varied significantly over the years. There are quiet periods of weeks, months, perhaps years when little intervention is required, while at other times there are clusters of events large and small that require much more attention. The incidents can range from the serious, such as posing a threat to my life and requiring major intervention, to mere annoyances that call merely for smoothing out a few wrinkles to protect my serenity and prevent life-altering frustration or aggravation. I still wasn't satisfied with the answer. I accept that you can't quantify it, I said, but can't you just take a wild guess? I'm curious about how much influence you have on my everyday life. Like, would it be a lot, somewhat, not much, just a little? I can't tell you, but I can show you, Paul said, shifting his body around on the bed to more squarely face me as I lay with my head resting on several pillows propped against the headboard. It was weird to witness his shifting of weight on the bed without an indication from the mattress that anything was there. How's that? I asked. I can leave you on your own for a while and intervene only and if you are facing serious trouble. That is, I wouldn't get involved in the minor events in your life that normally would call for some attention from me. My absence would give you some indication of my typical level of involvement. That was an interesting idea, I thought. We didn't arrive at any agreement at that time because I wanted to sleep on it. It could be a serious step if I decided to accept his suggestion. A short time later, about a week after Thanksgiving, I was driving from my house over to the local mall to do my Christmas shopping when Paul suddenly appeared beside me in the passenger seat. By then I had gotten fairly used to that little routine. The first couple of times it happened I nearly jumped out of my skin, and I mildly complained that he was going to give me a heart attack or at the very least cause a fender bender. We picked up the thread of our conversation in Minneapolis. Could there be any serious consequences if we did agree for you to go on vacation? I asked. Nothing serious, no, Paul replied. I would continue to be vigilant to try to guard you against catastrophe. I just wouldn't bother with the little chores that I sometimes get involved in to help your life run smoothly. You would have to deal with those yourself. That didn't seem like such a challenge. I consider myself rather self-sufficient and quite capable of tending to my own everyday affairs without anyone's assistance. I couldn't see what the big deal was in that regard. Something else that Paul said piqued my interest, however. You said you would be available to try to guard me against calamity, I said. That's all I can ever do try, he said. He gave me a strange look. I think I'd better clarify our relationship. He continued. I thought you understood it. But I'm getting the impression that you are laboring under some misconceptions. I do not and cannot guarantee your safety. You can't take it for granted that I can protect you from all harm. I still stop at all red traffic lights, I said. Yes, I know. I'm not saying you don't. But all people die even if they do have guardian angels. Bad things, terrible things, happen to people all the time. You will die someday just like everyone else. I cannot prevent that. I can try to help when I see that you are in danger. But that's all I can do. I have always succeeded, but one day either I will fail despite my best efforts or I will not intervene at all. That is the nature of life and death. I don't suppose you could try a little harder? I said, trying not to smile. I mean, this dying business, you couldn't pull a few strings, make an exception? No exceptions, he said straight-faced. Pity. I pulled into the parking lot of the mall, but we didn't enter the main building. We opted to stroll around the adjacent outdoor promenades and concourses lined with shops. I have no idea when that will be. He continued. Your death, I mean. I have no voice in that matter. I do know that on occasion I can shove you out of harm's way if you are about to step into the path of a fast-moving bus. But if you happen to fall off a 10-story building or catch a bullet through the heart, there would be very little I could do in such situations. Do you understand what I am saying? I understood clearly. No exceptions, angels or not. I can live with that, so to speak. So, let's try it then. What's the procedure? There's nothing to it, really. I'll just not get involved in the little things for a while. I'll still be available for any possible major events that might threaten you. How long do you want to shoot for? A couple of months. Will that give me enough time to make a comparison? Perhaps. What can I expect to happen during that time? You might notice more little annoyances. The days might not go as smoothly as you're used to. You might become irritable and agitated more frequently. That sort of thing. If that weighs true, then guardian angels are more intimately involved in the lives of their charges than I had realized. I had assumed that they played only a minimal role in everyday life and stepped in only during periods of critical need, perhaps once every few years. A skeptical noise escaped my lips as I blew a gust of air through them. It was a hard concept for me to swallow, and I wasn't buying it just yet. I asked if his prediction was specific to me or reflective in general of divine protectors and the individuals they oversee. There are instances of wide variation between individual angels with respect to the extent of their involvement with their wards, but his statement could be considered a generalization applicable to many others of his kind, he told me. I didn't think 2 months was enough time for me to determine if there would be any significant difference in my daily life. So I suggested that we conduct the experiment through March of 2003, approximately 4 months. Agreed, Paul said. I finished my Christmas shopping in less than 2 hours, which might be impressive to some, but it was quite unspectacular since I had only 2 names on my list. Paul hung out with me for about an hour and then disappeared. Later in the parking lot, when I was trying to juggle a couple of packages while trying to unlock the door to my pickup truck, I dropped the keys. I swore a mild crudity under my breath. Then I cracked my head on the side view mirror when I bent over to retrieve the keys, which caused me to drop the packages. I let out a yelp plus a louder and stronger curse word. I noticed in the mirror that I had cut my forehead and was bleeding slightly. Over the next several months, it seemed to me that I was a bit clumsier than usual, that there was more miscommunication with people that led to verbal disagreements, that people I came into contact with in the normal course of the day, employees of stores, medical offices, banks were surlier, less helpful, that I was not suffering fools as calmly as usual, that my patience was more strained, thinner. It could have been coincidence, but my attention to these rougher moments, which on the surface may appear to be merely routine matters, was heightened. Was I having a harder time than usual? Were the days stormier? Was I less relaxed than normal, more anxious? Were people more uncivil, or was I becoming less tolerant and thus making bigger issues out of relatively minor events? Was it my imagination, or were there instances of more raised voices than usual, more disruptions and complications involving routine matters, more frenzied and boisterous moments and fewer ones of peace and quiet? Something seemed to be amiss, but I couldn't lay the blame with any great degree of certainty on the absence of Paul's influence. And I couldn't really build a solid case for any claim that the stress level of my life had been elevated notch or two. The individual minor disturbances most likely would be regarded by most people as just the normal vicissitudes of life playing themselves out, but taken as a whole, they appeared to me, at least, to add up to something more. For example, while on my daily exercise routine shortly after Paul went on vacation, I had to cut my jog short and limp back to the house. It appeared that I had somehow twisted my left knee. Rest didn't resolve the problem and I had to abandon my regimen. I consulted a doctor, was not satisfied with the treatment, and became embroiled in a pitched battle that resulted in angry letters of complaint that I sent flying off to my HMO and state regulators. Then the bank where I had my checking account, mortgage, and line of credit was gobbled up by a global conglomerate. I called the new organization to get a few simple questions answered, like the whereabouts of $3,800 that had mysteriously disappeared from my checking account. Just my luck, my phone call was routed to the resident Axis Sally, whose sole job apparently was to see how much insolence she could dish out before the customer blew his stack and hung up. I should have known that it was a mistake to ask to speak to her supervisor. Naturally, it was a composite of Lizzie Borden and Ma Barker who came on the line after Axis Sally put me on hold for 15 minutes. So off went another flurry of angry, indignant letters to government regulators and a bank officer, who probably had a good laugh over the matter. Again, there was no response. Actually, that turned out to be a stroke of dumb luck. I was so incensed by the treatment at the hands of the sadistic wenches that I refinanced my mortgage with another bank and got a significantly lower interest rate. I got much satisfaction when I closed out my loan and cancelled my other accounts with the banking conglomerate. Despite that bright spot of serendipity, however, an epidemic of minor misfortunes began to plague me, consisting of hot tea spilled into the lap, dropped telephones, misplaced keys, broken eyeglasses, jammed garbage disposals and overflowing sinks, a rain-soaked truck interior from a window left open, a quantum leap in annoying phone calls from telemarketers, computer crashes, and various assaults on the body including scrapes, nicks, cuts, bruises, burns. I was sure I was setting some kind of a world record for the largest number of trivial mishaps to strike one person in the shortest period of time. I fired off another batch of biting letters when a replacement part for my kitchen range began malfunctioning again only a few months after I had paid $200 to have the appliance repaired. The service manager of the store where I had purchased the stove less than 2 years earlier informed me rather cavalierly over the phone that we don't manufacture them, we just sell them. A growing belief began taking root in my consciousness that good old American values such as pride of workmanship, common courtesy, a cooperative spirit of community, was in the process of crumbling. Yet I was determined to see the experiment through to the bitter end. Besides, mere coincidence could explain the cluster of minor confrontations, accidents, incidents, episodes, and disagreements that seemed to be plaguing me. I couldn't really convince myself of that, but I had to admit to the possibility. Deep in my guts, However, I was pretty certain that the absence of Paul's influence was being felt quite dramatically.